Matchbook presents First Years, a podcast for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Today, we're talking about the rules of the Triwizard Tournament, unity within Hogwarts, and we're diving back into some wand lore. Welcome everybody to episode 35 of First Years. So today we're going over chapters 16 through 18 of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. But before we dive in, I have some house points news. So in regards to house points, I will get you guys the totals for next episode. I've been switching over how I'm keeping track of house points, so it'll be a little bit easier on me. I've decided to take the leap and use technology to help me. So I will have those tallies for you for the next episode, but I do want to give some house points. I am awarding 50 points to Ravenclaw, thanks to Simone, who recently discovered the podcast and sent me the sweetest DM. Thank you so much. I am so glad to get you started on your Harry Potter journey and that you are enjoying the series and you're enjoying the episodes. Thank you so much. So Ravenclaw is up 50 points. If you guys would like to earn more points for your houses, you can always do so by rating and reviewing the podcast and leaving your name in Hogwarts House to get a shout out on here, as well as house points. You can also participate in our Mindful Magic Mondays and in our trivia, which we do every Wednesday. Remember that if your house wins the House Cup at the end of Goblet of Fire, if you are a member of that house, you get put into a raffle to win a prize. So if you want a chance at winning, make sure your house wins and go get those points. So let's dive right in. So where we left off last episode was that the students from Durmstrang and the students from Beauxbatons have arrived at Hogwarts for the Triwizard Tournament. So we start off right where we left off, where we get to see the different students. And two things occurred to me at the beginning of this chapter. One, I kind of felt that Hermione was being a little hypocritical, because everyone's swooning over Crumb, and she's just like, oh, come on, like, what are you doing? But two books ago, she was swooning over Lockhart. So I think she needs to not judge everybody for swooning over a Quidditch celebrity. Not only that, but this competition is supposed to be about magical cooperation between different schools and friendly competition between different students. And sort of immediately we see that this isn't really the case among the students. Like, the headmasters seem to get along fine, but the students themselves seem to have issues. For example, Beauxbatons, they seem cold, and Hermione's like, well, why didn't they bring cloaks? And also, it seems that Beauxbatons are, like, very unhappy to be there. They're described as looking glum. And the Durmstrang students do seem to be impressed by the Great Hall. But we also see here the way that the students interact differently with their headmasters. So, for example, the Beauxbatons students stand until their headmistress sits down, and then they sit down, which we don't see at Hogwarts at all. Actually, the students laugh when they see this, because Dumbledore's never been that kind of person, right? So we finally have all of the students there, and the opening ceremony, if you will, of the Triwizard Tournament begins. And was anyone else stopped by the fact that the Goblet of Fire is kept in what is called a casket, and that this tournament had enough people die during it that it was canceled for a while and now needs an age restriction. Because that was not lost on me. I don't know if that's... I'm sure casket is probably the proper definition for whatever it's kept in, but I just felt that the term casket connected with this tournament where people have died many times was not lost on me at all. So we find out that the tournament is comprised of three different tasks. And these tasks will test the champion's, quote, magical prowess, their daring, their powers of deduction, and their ability to cope with danger, unquote. To me, that kind of sounds like it's testing the different qualities of the different Hogwarts houses. Now, we don't know if the other schools have different houses or like a sorting ceremony of any kind, but this definitely stood out to me as the different qualities of the Hogwarts houses, which I think is really interesting because if those are all really important qualities for a wizard to have, then sort of Hogwarts itself as a symbol would be like a fully well-rounded wizard. But we have students being divided up into these different categories where like one trait is prized more important than another one. So it's really interesting to see how it's designed to test them on these qualities where like all together, this unity of like all of these traits make someone a powerful wizard or make up like, you know, the champion of the Triwizard Tournament. And yet we only ever see these traits individually in different students of different houses. After the meal, Harry runs into Karkaroff. And we're going to talk about unity again in a little bit. But first, so at the end of the meal, Harry runs into Karkaroff, who is the headmaster of Durmstrang. And he stops in his tracks when he recognizes him. And the Durmstrang students do too. And we see here how widespread Harry's fame is. You know, it's not just the UK, it's everywhere in the wizarding world, which we've heard before, but we haven't really seen it in action. You know, we saw a glimpse of the presence of Voldemort in the wizarding world at the Quidditch World Cup and how everybody reacted to seeing the Dark Mark and the Death Eaters there. But here we really see Harry being recognized by somebody that isn't in London or isn't at school. And we also see Moody here. He's like protecting Harry, where he's like, yep, that's him. Stop staring. Leave him alone. And Karkaroff is described as being fearful and furious at Moody. So what kind of history is there? We know that Moody used to catch dark wizards, and we also know that they teach the dark arts at Durmstrang. So what do you think the connection is there between them? We also learn not to underestimate Dumbledore. He did think of everything when he drew the age line. An aging potion definitely was not going to work. But I also think it's really great that we see Dumbledore's sense of humor here. And that it's not necessarily a bad punishment. He's not necessarily angry at people who are trying to, you know, jump the age line with a potion. So the punishment of that is more like funny and like maybe embarrassing, you know, where you grow a beard instead of like getting detention or something like that. It's a really fun way for him to teach them a lesson. And a lesson that can easily be reversed by Madame Pomfrey. So let's talk about unity within the wizarding world and within Hogwarts. We asked in a previous episode whether or not the Hogwarts students would come together to celebrate their champion. But right away, we see people going back and forth over who can and can't be their champion. Harry says, we can't have a Slytherin champion. Seamus says, all the Hufflepuffs are talking about Diggory, but I wouldn't have thought that he'd want to risk his good looks. I don't know if you can hear that, but my hands are in the air right now in disbelief, because what has Cedric Diggory done to deserve this? And maybe we get these details because he ultimately does get chosen as champion, so we sort of needed some more details about him and how people felt about him ahead of time. But think about what we know about Cedric by now. He wanted to call off the match that he won last year when Harry fell off his broom because he knew it was unfair. In our interactions with him, he has been nothing but nice. Yes, his dad has been kind of like really awkward in like thinking that Cedric's better than Harry, but Cedric seemed just as like embarrassed about that moment as our main characters did. So what is the deal? Because Seamus also calls him a pretty boy and several Hufflepuffs glare at him. Why is there no house unity within Hogwarts for an event like this? And also, going along with that, Cedric is also trying to be nice about the whole thing after Harry's name gets selected from the Goblet of Fire. You know, like they're walking back and he's like, so we're competing against each other again. And he's trying to be like nice about it and not a jerk about it. I just feel like I don't understand why everybody hates Cedric at this point in the book. I don't understand. He's done nothing wrong. So during this moment where the Hogwarts champions are called, Ron actively says no when Cedric's name is called. I don't understand. And the Hufflepuffs cheer so loudly for Cedric that it goes on for a while. And I feel like this is the first time that we've really seen people from Hufflepuff get highlighted in this series. So it's a big moment for them, and it's also a big moment for us as readers to really see what Hufflepuff can do. You know, we have a Hufflepuff champion. This is somebody who it was decided by the Goblet of Fire was the best person for the job. Not necessarily a Gryffindor or a Ravenclaw or a Slytherin, but a Hufflepuff. So we're going to get to see during the rest of the book how this plays out and see, you know, what qualities of Hufflepuff can be highlighted, and we get to really have representation from another house in within the plot. So Harry's name gets called, and I have never felt so terrible for Harry in this moment, where you can just feel every single pair of eyes on him and how mad everybody is, and he has to walk the entire length of the Great Hall in front of everybody. I was cringing. And I also really liked the detail when Harry goes into the room of first Fleur thinking that he is a messenger, and secondly the line where it says that the other champion seemed so much taller than he was, to really make the point that he is much younger and they are older and wiser and much better equipped to handle this situation than he is. Now, Harry says that he did not enter his name into the Goblet of Fire. Somebody else had to have done it for him. Harry is 14 and yet still has to compete because of a binding magical contract, according to the goblet and also the rules of the Triwizard Tournament. My question is, what constitutes a binding magical contract? Can you be bound to a magical contract if you are not the one who, for lack of a better term, signed your name to it? Also, if they changed the rules so that only people over 17 can compete, why doesn't that automatically disqualify Harry? You know, why isn't that a big enough rule for Harry to be automatically disqualified? Why does the goblet seem to have more power than the ministry officials? What are these rules? Who wrote them? Why can't they be changed? Because we know that they're in a rule book. They talk about a rule book that Mr. Crouch knows back to front, apparently. Why wasn't the age restriction that they decided to introduce this year written into the rule book? I don't understand. Because it says, quote, the rules state clearly that those people whose names come out of the Goblet of Fire are bound to compete in the tournament. So what would happen if Harry just said, no, thanks, but no thanks, I'm not doing this? What do you think the consequences are of a binding magical contract? What binds Harry to this contract? And also, again, I'm gonna ask it again, how are you bound to a contract that you yourself didn't sign, but somebody signed your name for you? What do you guys think? Also, what do you think happened? Because everyone seems to think that Harry either managed to find a way around the age line or he got an older student to do it for him. Neither of which is true. And then Moody comes in and he has a theory that someone who was a very powerful wizard confunded the cup to fool it into thinking that there were four schools instead of three, and put Harry's name into the goblet in hopes that he would die during the tournament. And the reason that Moody is able to come up with that is that he says it used to be his job to think as dark wizards do. And so, do you guys buy that? Also, going back to the contract thing, if the cup is able to be confunded, why aren't like new rules allowed to be implemented? And also, wouldn't that also make a contract void? I don't know. What do you guys think? Because there's another part here where there's a shot at him saying that Moody is teaching the students to fear assassination attempts, and that it's an odd quality for a Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. Why would that be an odd quality for a Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher? Isn't that the whole point of teaching Defense Against the Dark Arts? I mean, maybe not specifically assassination attempts, but defending yourself or being ready for dark arts to come at you, I would think, would be part of that job. And Harry, after all of this, is wondering why someone would put his name in the Goblet of Fire. And at first he thinks, okay, maybe a joke to embarrass him, you know, to get him in trouble. So whose side are we on here? Are we on Harry's side, that it was someone who just wanted to play a joke on him? A very serious joke, if I might add. Or are you on Moody's side and you think it's something much more serious and someone is actively trying to kill Harry? If you remember all the way back to chapter 1 of this book, it opened with Voldemort and Wormtail, and they were talking about having a clear path to Harry Potter. So we know in general that Voldemort is after Harry. But we also know at the same time that he has a specific concrete plan that he has been working on that we will probably see at some point in this book. So do you think this is part of his plan? Or do you think he has a completely separate plan and Harry just has incredibly bad luck? The champions will face three tasks, the first of which they aren't told what it is. Because they're saying that to have courage in the face of the unknown is an important quality for wizards to have. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that specific trait is what's focused on for the first task to open the Triwizard Tournament? And also, why do you think, you know, that's something that these officials say, that it's a very important quality for wizards to have? Let me know. I really want to hear your guys' thoughts on that. So shoot me an email, firstyearspodcast@gmail.com, or connect with me on Twitter or Instagram @firstyearspod. But we're not done yet. I know that sounds like I'm at the end of the episode, but I'm not. So our other huge conflict in these chapters is that we have a huge conflict between Harry and Ron. The fact that Ron doesn't believe that Harry did not put his name in the Goblet of Fire. So he's jealous, and he's upset because he would have expected Harry to share that information with him so that they could, you know, break the rules together. You know, and he even brings up the fact that Harry had stated that he would have done it late in the evening so that no one would see him. So why do you think that Ron doesn't believe him? Because of all the people, wouldn't you believe your best friend? What reason do you think, like, what reason do you think Ron has, like, that Ron believes that Harry would lie to him for? Like, why, if Ron thinks that Harry is lying to him, what reason does he have to think that Harry is lying to him? If Harry was already allowed to compete and wanted to compete and had put his name in the Goblet of Fire, don't you think he would have shared the reason? Like the way he did it, at least with Ron of all people? And why is Hermione the one to believe him now? Is it because she's more practical normally? Because this is really one of the first times where we see a really big divide between Harry and Ron. Normally, we see a divide between Harry or Ron with Hermione. This is really the first time that Harry and Ron have gotten into a fight. And it sort of just piles on through these chapters, because then Hedwig is mad at him for not using her to deliver the letter to Sirius. So now two people that are closest to Harry are mad at him for something that he literally can't help. You know, thankfully, Hagrid does believe him. And I think we're finally seeing the pressures and the frustrations of being in a position like Harry's, you know, where he's famous. He had a dark wizard go after him, and he really can't catch a break. He's famous for the most horrible experience of his entire life. And this whole situation is interfering in his relationships, and it's got to be exhausting. You know, Harry didn't ask for any of this. Yet he's constantly, throughout his life, been put in situations where he needs to handle things. You know, this moment is kind of representative of Harry's life in general. You know, he didn't ask to be targeted by Voldemort. He didn't ask for the fame that he has. And if we think about what Harry has dealt with since book one, protecting the Sorcerer's Stone, solving the mystery of the Chamber of Secrets and saving Ginny's life, confronting Sirius Black and discovering the truth about that whole situation. Yeah, I think Harry is someone who acts when he has to in order to protect others. But really, I think that part of these situations is that they're all connected to him by Voldemort, which puts a responsibility on his shoulders to handle these situations. Like, yes, Harry probably would have gone down to save Ginny anyway in book two, but he's directly connected to that whole mess because he can talk to snakes, and everyone thought that he was the heir of Slytherin. So he's really just spent his whole life dealing with situations as a product of what Voldemort did, while Harry's just like trying to be as normal as he possibly can. And I think that this situation speaks to how painful it can be to get into a fight with your friends. You know, Ron has always been on Harry's side. These chapters even point that out, that Harry only felt this terrible during second year when everybody hated him. but at least Ron was there by his side and believed him then and supported him. Now, Harry doesn't even have that. Yes, he has Hermione and Hagrid, but it's not the same. Ron was his first friend, like, ever. He helped him navigate, you know, the wizarding world and Hogwarts for the first time. That's an incredible loss for him. And it's kind of bizarre that, you know, Ron knows Harry so well, and yet he still thinks that Harry put his name in the Goblet of Fire. And everyone seems to think so. Even Cedric and Rita Skeeter don't believe Harry when he's like, no, I really didn't put my name in the Goblet of Fire. They're like, uh-huh, sure, okay. It's just terrible, and I feel terrible for Harry and for Ron, too, for, you know, for feeling, like, second best, like Hermione points out. Like, he's always in the shadow of his brothers, and he's always in the shadow of Harry, and it finally was too much. You know, it's this really, really tragic moment between the two of them where Harry really needs his best friend above everyone else during this time, and he just doesn't have access to him right now. And I was reminded throughout these chapters of, like, the cruelty of teenagers, if I can call it that, where teenagers can just be so terrible to each other because everyone is ganging up on Harry now. We expect it from the Slytherins at this point, right? But everyone really seems to turn on Harry outside of Gryffindor. The Hufflepuffs think that he's taking the glory away from Cedric and their house, which I totally get. They don't get the spotlight very often, and here is their chance, and now Hogwarts can't come together around a single champion. They're going to be divided between the two. And we see the Slytherins all wearing badges that root for Cedric and say, Potter stinks, which is interesting that the Slytherins can come together to support someone from Hufflepuff, because usually the whole school tends to root against Slytherin. But the Slytherins can get behind Hufflepuff. So this whole thing just reminds me of how terrible people in their teens, especially at school, can be to one another. You know, it really knows no bounds sometimes. So for the last leg of this podcast, let's talk about wands again. So we get a wand weighing ceremony where Ollivander comes in and he makes sure that everyone's wand is suitable and up for the task of, or up for the three tasks, I guess I should say, of the Triwizard Tournament. And here, right before this, is where we meet Rita Skeeter for the first time. And she is a character. My big question was, when I first met her, was, in what world is it appropriate for a grown woman to bring a 14-year-old boy into a broom cupboard? And, like, nobody questions it. She's interviewing Harry, she's using a quick quotes quill, and Harry catches that it's calling the scar on his forehead an ugly scar that disfigures Harry's face. And I think we get a very clear sense of the kind of person that Rita Skeeter is and the kind of reporter that she is. But we also get a sense of these other characters through their wands. So for this, I broke out my resources on wands. The only ones that I really couldn't find were Fleur Delacour, because Ollivander does not make wands out of that wood or out of the core that she uses. So I did my own research to learn about rosewood, and it is associated with a strong spirit, vulnerability, and inner conflict. Fleur's wand is also probably absolutely gorgeous because the colors of rosewood have a range from black to red. It's a wood that's been prized for instruments, to make jewelry boxes and furniture. And in a more symbolic spiritual sense, it's associated with listening to your heart, opening up to being vulnerable. It symbolizes kindness and having a good heart. And it's also good for divination and love charms, which is interesting when you think about how she is part Vila and how people have been reacting to her since she showed up in this book. Her wand is 9.5 inches. It's inflexible, which I thought was interesting, so maybe she's stubborn. It's made of rosewood, and the core has a hair from a Vila. So we have Floor being part Vila, rosewood being good for love spells, as well as the core being a hair from a Vila. And Ollivander says that he doesn't usually use Vila hair in his wands because they can make for temperamental wands, so he doesn't use them in his own work. But it seems to work for Floor. So what do we make of that? Of that, like, rosewood being associated with kindness and a good heart, also with wands that can be temperamental and this inflexibility of her wand. Meanwhile, Cedric's wand is 12.25 inches. It's made of ash, it's pleasantly springy, and it has a unicorn hair core. So ash wood, which Ollivander uses, those wands tend to be very connected to their owners, and they shouldn't be passed on to others because they'll actually lose their power. And it says that the tendency to do this is extreme if the core has unicorn hair, which Cedric's does. Ollivander also says that ash is a stubborn wood, and that the wizard who has wands like these usually aren't swayed from their beliefs. So the owner can be, like, stubborn, but also courageous, but never arrogant. So I think that applies to Cedric from what we've seen so far and tells us a lot about him, and also goes along with my reasoning that there's no reason to hate Cedric. Come on now. We've gone over wand cores before, but for a refresher on unicorn hair, it produces the most consistent magic. It's a very faithful core, but it might not be the strongest of wands. Crumb, meanwhile, his wand is 10.25 inches. It's made of hornbeam, and it has a dragon heartstring core. And it was not made by Ollivander, but it was made by a wand maker named Grigorovich. Now, hornbeam is a wand wood that Ollivander does use. So he says that it usually picks someone for life, and it's someone who has, like, a singular passion or vision that they usually realize. They're very adaptable to their owners, and especially, like, with their owners, the type of magic that they use. So it becomes a very personalized wand, and that the wands won't perform magic that goes against their owner's principles, which I thought was really interesting. Meanwhile, Dragon Heartstring produces wands with the most power, and they tend to learn more quickly than other types of cores. These wands also might change allegiance, but they'll always have, like, a strong bond to their owners. These wands are also the easiest to turn to the dark arts. Remember, Durmstrang does teach the dark arts, and they're also prone to accidents because they're temperamental. So we have two wands in this group that are deemed as possibly temperamental. So what do you think that says about their owners? What do you think we've learned about each of these characters through their wands? And also, how do you think this informs us of how each person will do in the tournament? Because I think we need to remember that as we're getting insights into the personalities of each of these people, that they were selected for the tournament as the best option. So we need to keep that in mind, that each of these people is talented enough to be here and talented enough to participate. I was going to say fight, to participate in this tournament. So now we're kind of getting into, as we speculate about that, we're getting into more of a, not necessarily who is, I mean, yes, who's stronger than the other, but it's not a very obvious strength of, like, someone literally overpowering somebody else, because wizards can be talented with all of these different qualities and all of these different wands, but maybe let's think more of like how these wands can support these champions in what they are going to face in these next three tasks. Let's get into the, you know, let's get into the theory of magic and sort of the little nuances between very talented wizards. And let me know what you think is going to happen based off of all of that. You can let me know at firstyearspodcast@gmail.com or connect with me on social media at firstyearspod. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram under that username. So for the following episode, you need to read chapters 19 and 20, and I will see you guys next time. First Years is a production of Matchbook. It's produced by Quinn Parker and myself, Sarah Jones-Dittmeyer. All sources can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeier. Please remember that staying a Harry Potter fan is the biggest form of revolt that you can have, and we are committed to continuing to make this fandom and this community safe and welcoming to everybody.